Well, it's a great honor to be introducing the two of you today for this dialogue on spiritual warfare. Obviously, I felt called to bring the two of you in particular together on this because you're both friends, I'd say brothers and interlocutors on the journey of making sense of this. And this is it's a hot topic for people who are wrestling with Christianity, how to integrate this metaphorically, literally, metaphysically. What does it mean to engage in spiritual warfare in our lives? And the two of you are also going to be joining for the Lord of the Rings event next week. And of course, that story is kind of saturated with these themes as well. So there's a masculine heroic call, and that's something that Jordan with the brotherhood that he's been running and the forthcoming Council of Kings is you know, creating those spaces to incubate those conversations as well. So, and Ken, of course, I've introduced you many times. I don't know what to say in this moment, except you're a wonderful, wonderful interlocutor and philosopher to bring on board for this conversation. So with that, I just want to invite, you know, whatever reflections have come for you guys in the run-up to this conversation, where are you at in this moment in relation to spiritual warfare? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, well, thank you. I guess I'll start a little bit here. Thanks for setting this up and inviting me, Jacob. I'm happy to be here. It's nice to meet you, Jordan. One of the things, so to put a couple frames up, spiritual warfare and just spirituality in general is sort of this, in the larger frame, it's an interesting thing because it felt like growing up, it was, you know, the normal position was just to say, nah, there's not really anything going on there. That's all just sort of hocus pocus weird stuff. And in the Christian milieu that I was brought up in, it was just sort of like, yeah, it's sort of weird stuff, but we kind of believe in it, but we don't really know what it means. And then, you know, my friends outside the church just, it's all just nonsense. And now there's this increasing sensibility that people seem to have that there is something going on that's above us. There are intelligences above us, and there's all sorts of different language to talk about that, but it's acquiring more of a sense of reality, I think, for even just your average person. For me personally, this is a very alive topic right now because I actually have first degree family members who I would say are in the throes of quite intense spiritual warfare. And so I'm involved with that, and I'm trying to understand and make sense of it. There's all sorts of different things that I've found interesting and helpful. One of the things I've been listening to, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's called the Lord of Spirits podcast. Father Stephen DeYoung, who's a Orthodox priest, and Father Andrew Damick, who's also another Orthodox priest, just came across my radar recently because Father Stephen DeYoung spoke at the Symbolic World Conference, Symbolic World Summit, I think was what it was called. And it's kind of a deep dive into what the spiritual world looks like from a Christian, especially an Orthodox Christian lens. It's just very different than the sort of Christian lens of spirituality that I was brought up with. So that's been really interesting. So I've got some of those things running in the background for me. So that's sort of where I'm coming from a little bit.
Cool. Thanks for that, Ken. And as for me, in terms of what spiritual warfare means to me at this point, good to be here with both of you guys too. It really can be summarized as saying that there are, in my view, forces on Earth that don't want humanity to thrive and to, let's say, liberate itself or discover salvation or freedom or deep peace and restfulness within oneself. These forces would prefer for humanity to be in a state of agitation, restlessness, anxiety, suffering, despair, darkness, desolation, and inner death. And these forces can be conceptualized as being purely psychological or archetypal in nature. Or you can take that extra leap and you can say, actually, these are, you know, objectively real entities or demonic intelligences, parasitic intelligences that are out there in some sense. And to me, it doesn't, I think people probably get too hung up on that type of distinction. To me, there's not actually that big of a difference, or if any difference, between the purportedly psycho-archetypal and the, you know, objectively really out there interpretation of things. But in my experience, and I think any honest observer of the human experience and of Earth at this juncture, you know, it's very easily observable that the condition of vast quantities of people on this planet, hundreds of millions, if not billions of people at this stage of civilization, is one of varying degrees of inner torment. There's a lot of very deep suffering going on the planet. And quite clearly, there are forces that somehow lead in that direction. And I guess, yeah, based on my experience with psychedelics, as well as sober experience too, though, I can just say that I've had many direct firsthand encounters with entities of whatever nature that seem to belong in this category of entities that don't want humanity to thrive and liberate itself, and that in some sense seem to be feeding on humanity's suffering, or somehow like benefiting from keeping humanity trapped in some kind of frequency prison or frequency grid of a lower nature, you could say. So when I speak about spiritual warfare, that's generally what I'm referring to, is the existence of such entities. And then the question of how do we, you know, skillfully deal with this reality.
Thank you. Yeah, that was really excellent. I'm really interested to hear what comes up for you, Ken. I just wanted to pull out a few pieces I heard in that, Jordan. The first is that there are, and this is something I heard Jordan Peterson articulate very well. You have these emotions, you know, things like anger or resentment or suffering or lack, and that these exist within individuals, but they exist within so many individuals that there can be a kind of aggregate of the suffering of all of those people, which becomes this kind of spirit or meta archetypal form that lives beyond the individual instantiation of that form. And so I think one of the things I've found in the last few years is that most people, especially people who don't really relate to religion or Christianity or God, they'll always say, I believe in energies. I believe in good and bad energies. And there's something to that that actually opens up once you, especially working with entheogens and plant medicines, is you really begin to perceive energy, and you can start to see like there is this potential of a parasitic quality, like when somebody is really possessed with a kind of lack for their entire life. It, you know, you can kind of perceive that there's the person, and then there's this piece that's latched on to the person. Or if somebody's really been downtrodden by something their whole life, they'll actually physically, you know, start to kind of instantiate that, and you can see the way somebody holds themselves. And I think there are people with deeper levels of spiritual attunement who can perceive those energies and perceive, oh, this person is actually bringing something with them. And the last piece I want to introduce here is the sense that there's a sense that it's possible to become threatening to those entities. It's possible to become threatening to lack, to become dangerous to brokenness. And that when you are in your potency, in your light, is when you may actually start to see those things kind of like they'll come forth, in, you know, principally through people that hold them. And you can almost see like, oh, you know, from a psychological perspective, I've triggered that part that doesn't want to be illuminated or addressed or loved, and it goes on the offensive to kind of defend itself. But there's something also equally, you know, we can really consider that demonic in another sense. So I want to hand it to you in this moment, Cam.
Yeah, well, the one thing that really struck me of what you said, Jordan, was the to point out the sort of silliness of trying to argue about the reality of these things and categorize them in reality. It's sort of, I do think that's sort of an obstruction. And I think that's actually, there's something about that that then can tie into what you're saying, Jacob, because for me, one of the ways it seems like one of the chief tactics of these sort of parasitic energies or entities is to confuse us, right? It's a game of smoke and mirrors to make you look in the wrong direction so that they can siphon off the energy that you have. And I think a basic way of how it works is sort of like, well, our capacity to pay attention to the world is actually the means by which that's like the deep power that we have is our attention capacity. And if our attention capacity can get siphoned into a particular patterning of reality that is negative, then we're sort of serving that entity, right? You brought up resentment or anger. And for me, that's like the baseline hook of any demonic entity is if they can hook you into if there's a traumatic event that they can get you to be resentful over, that's a hook where they can just pull energy, right? And it can bind you down into this process of being really confused about which way is up, right? It's really difficult to have any sense of your own personal agency to actually like calm down and center enough to actually look around you and see what might be good in this moment when you have an underlying resentment that is running your life. And that will get you trapped into some pattern that then you begin expressing. Like you said, right? Like you sort of become possessed by this thing and then you express it towards someone else when they probably, like you said, when they trigger it by trying to love that part of you that is stuck in the resentment. Which is, I guess, one more thing with that. This is something I've been thinking about, and I tweeted the other day that like, I think one of the best tricks of Satan and parasitic forces in general is to convince you that you need to fight them, because there's this active engagement of like resistance and fighting that gets you caught in that smoke and mirrors game versus a one of I think the wisest things that I learned early in my journey was that this idea that love is the most powerful thing in the universe, and that there's a forgiving love that can turn around and look it in the face, whatever it is, right? If it, like in that moment on the psychedelic journey where I remember very clearly, I think it was my second or third journey, like I was a very like Lord of the Rings moment of Frodo in the cave with the spider. There was this huge spider that came down on me, and I was very like, it was a crazy moment, and the anxiety and fear and all of that was just so huge. And the thing that I had in my mind with me that whole time was just love is the most powerful thing in the universe. And so I just sat there with it and I was like, okay, I love you. Like, do your worst. And then it just sort of like stopped, and like in the moment, in the experience, it just sort of was like, ah, whatever, and just walked away. It was like, it was just, it was just bored of me at that moment. And so for me, that's always, yeah, there's this like loving forgiveness of the thing that always seems to be the way out. And I don't know that I have a great like argument to put forward right now for that, but that in my experience has been the thing.
Yeah, I would echo that and say in my experience too, I've received the message many times that love is the final medicine. Love is that which heals and harmonizes all things. And really, I've gotten the strong sense that these demonic entities are actually more in need of that unconditional love than anything else in creation. You know, very often these entities are, they can be seen as being associated with the most rejected aspects of our own selves and our own psyches. That's often like where they hook into us, you could say, or perhaps where they originate from. It's like if you had been rejected and locked in a dark basement of repression for eons and just left down there to contort and fester, you know, you would probably have turned into something kind of angry and ugly too. And so, yeah, to me, these types of entities are profoundly in need of unconditional love, more so than like anything else in creation. The most kind of demonic, which I think, yeah, is really, it's hard for a lot of people to wrap their minds around something like that. I mean, even the average Christian still believes in a permanent hell where these types of things and bad people are just going to burn for eternity. And there is no redemption for entities that have committed certain wrongdoings. But even in the Bible, it talks about Jesus going down to hell and preaching to the entities burning in hell, which suggests a potential redemption, even for the worst of the worst, those that have reached the most contorted hellish condition. And for me, as a believer in universal salvation and universal redemption, I do believe that even that you can never go too far from home without being able to come back. And I believe that these entities eventually will all be reconciled with God and redeemed. And I think we can help with that by embodying what Jesus suggested, which is love your enemies. And one last piece that I'll drop in there is just that I think, especially when dealing with a Christian framing of this subject, the world can quickly start to look very black and white. Like it's either, you're either on the side of the good guys, AKA the Christians who've accepted Christ as their Lord and Savior, and everything else is demonic in some sense. Everything else is like poisoned. And, you know, a lot of Christians really do frame things this way in my experience. And to me, that's really a caricature of the reality that we're dealing with. I feel that God is far too creative and multidimensional and slippery and too much of a trickster to create things in such a simplistic way where it's just like, yeah, there's just black and white. There's no shades in between. To me, it's a much more ambiguous super rainbow of every imaginable shade and texture. And you've got similar as when you look out at humanity, you've got every different type of person. And we all have like many kind of sub personalities and parts, some of which are more angelic, some are more demonic, some are more like tricksters and you don't really know. And there's just every shade and flavor inside of every single one of us. So when you imagine that every entity is that way and every entity is full of these flavors, you end up with this picture of a remarkably ambiguous universe, just filled with a rainbow of beings of every imaginable shade and texture. And I think that that is a more interesting frame to engage this discussion from than the super black and white frame as well. So,
yeah. Yeah, thank you, Jordan. I appreciate you also mentioning the plant medicine space, Ken. It's definitely a big piece of what's prompted this conversation for me. And I have a sense that Jordan and later myself have crossed some threshold in relationship to plant medicine in which the notion of spiritual warfare became more relevant in that space, at least speaking for myself, a sense that the language of spiritual warfare was showing me something about how to be properly armed and armored to enter into this visionary space. And there's almost an extent to which the more prepared you are for a greater battle, the more likely that's going to come as well. And so there's something that Christianity is holding in this respect, that the New Age and the general psychedelic discourse and certainly secular society is not holding, which is, it's something to do with being armored with faith and being able to somehow kind of invoke and bring forth the potency of that. I think that the vision space, the ayahuasca space, acts as a kind of training ground for what then it's ultimately for encounters in the rest of our lives. That this vision space is the training for. And it was interesting because the retreat that Jordan organized in December that we were on, there was a number of things where it seemed like you were kind of getting into something a little bit before me, and then you were telling me about it, in this case, like experiences of spiritual warfare that you had had like a week before of encountering these entities, and using invocation in the medicine space to respond to that. And as a result of that prompting, then I was also like having that come through significantly right off the bat, and finding that that was a really powerful way for me to come in. And it was a very, there were aspects of it which definitely bore out that kind of exorcist movie kind of thing. There was a lot of use of my hands, and there was a lot of using of the kind of physicality of the shape of the cross, and repetition of certain invocations. I love you being one of them. And, you know, invoking Christ to bring about healing as a kind of directive towards whatever's coming, whether it's in myself or I'm sensing it in somebody else in the space. And just like doing that again and again with a kind of devotional, like a mantra. And I've had experiences since then on another medicine journey where I did have this kind of deformed, repulsive insectoid kind of figure come forward, that I really felt like ambiguous towards, and I don't know how to respond to this. And there was some remembrance of make the I love you move towards, and like make the I love you come into intimacy with whatever that kind of repulsive thing is. And in doing that, it did transform and kind of became like this more light figure. Like the figure itself was liberated through my loving of it, rather than it being an alienation. And so this is a really curious quality. And then at the same time, we do have this bigger conversation with Jonathan Pajau and others about to what extent the darkness in the world and the potentialities of systems of global control and things of this nature can also be understood as these kinds of aggregate parasitic forces manifesting in the world, and that there is actually needed some sort of warriors of light and some sort of field of resonance that can out resonate the darkness. So I'm really interested to explore that, and I also invite both of you, like, reflections on what how do we act, you know, coming from the standpoint that this is real, that we're engaged in this, how do we engage in it more effectively? What does that look like? I've been thinking about the gym as it's like, does the physical training actually make me a better spiritual warrior? Does making really beautiful medicinal rap music, is that a weapon in the spiritual battle? These kinds of questions.
Couple of things I can jump in with just before I forget. Now I'm gonna just blank out and forget both of them. Let's see. Oh yeah, the field of resonance point. It made me think of the where two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in their midst. In my experience, we are much more protected from these forces when we do come together in community, and we form communities of worship and communities that are explicitly recognizing divinity in whatever form, and coming together with others who are connected to divinity, or even just people connected to the heart. There is strength in numbers, not only from a physical but also a spiritual and metaphysical perspective, I think. And another piece that harkens back, I think, to something Ken mentioned earlier, is just a piece around the level of belief that we give to these things. I think Ken said something about this, but it's a really tricky dance. I think there's a great C.S. Lewis quote about this too that I can't remember off the top of my head, but the essence of it is essentially like, you do want to acknowledge the existence of these things and kind of prepare yourself and, in a sense, train and take steps to protect yourself without going full on into like completely concretizing and I deeply believe in this and I'm researching this all the time and I'm looking at this all the time and I'm talking about it all the time, because you end up like actually feeding that reality more by concretizing it too much. So that's just something I want to make people aware of, is like, I generally try not to talk about this subject to people too much, because I think there can be a tendency, especially in the age of YouTube algorithms, where if you watch one documentary about this type of thing, suddenly you get introduced to 15 more, and next thing you know, you're living in a very ominous reality tunnel that you can't easily snap out of. And I feel that's actually another way that these parasitic energies are feeding on people, is by getting people to overinvest in this subject area. So there's a tricky dance of like acknowledging it, learning how to protect yourself, taking basic precautions, but then basically just focusing on the North Star of love and God and truth and beauty, and just like being that, going toward that, living that in as humble and grounded and serviceful and authentic of a way as flows true through you, and not overemphasizing like these entities or over fixating on them, but just essentially becoming the light and understanding that that is really the best thing you can do, is just be incarnated on this earth as light and be carrying the light with you and forming communities of light and just giving love to everything, whatever it is, whatever shows up in your field, just giving it unconditional love and being transparent to that unconditional love. And other than that, just taking steps for protection, like equipping yourself with the armor of God, like it says in the Bible. And for me, I genuinely like to do deep visualizations where I visualize this translucent, shimmering, energetic light armor, you know, encircling myself, and I charge it up and I center myself in this glowing orb of the heart, and I put my roots deep in the earth and the branches celestial, up the branches up to the heavens. And you know, everybody can find their own form of practices like that, but there are ways to just ongoingly kind of strengthen your own armor, protect yourself, and then otherwise just, yeah, don't look in the direction of that stuff more than you need to, and basically just be the light. That's what I would say.
Yeah, this is really good. I got a couple things I want to throw out here to position the Christian thing a little bit. Is something really interesting that I learned from this Lord of Spirits podcast is the idea that in the origin story of Satan, we partially because of translation issues, it's been sort of misunderstood that Satan is envious of God. But the notion is actually something more like Satan is envious of man. Because the angels have this creation, they're created with a sort of set place. Like they have their role. They don't really reproduce. They're servants of God. They have some sort of free will, but they don't have the same capacity that humans have to sort of infinitely transcend more and more into God's nature. Whereas human beings have this thing where we're sort of the imaged and the pup, we're the image of God with the potential of becoming the likeness of God, right? We have this resonance with God such that we can move ever further into God's nature, whereas the angels have more of just like they're the servants of God. And so there's this way in which we can think of the negative and the positive players in the angelic lower G God space as, you know, they're vectored on us, right? And they're either trying to help us or they're envious of us. And then another layer with the black and white thing, which I thank you for bringing that in, Jordan, because yeah, it's really ambiguous actually, even in the scriptures, right? Because like in the beginning of Job, you know, Satan's not even really a person. It's an office in Job, right? The adversary, the accuser shows up at the council of God and God's sort of like, he's working for God, right? There's another place in 2 Kings where God sort of commissions this spirit, this lying spirit, to go and speak through the mouths of the prophets of Ahab to convince him to go make a disastrous decision that will end up in his death, right? And it's pretty clear in the story that, like, you know, God's sort of playing both sides here. And that notion of like, okay, you can't get outside of God's space, right? Like, that's sort of by definition, you can't get outside of it. So even the dark forces, for one thing, humans actually have more authority. So especially even like how you said, Jordan, like, be careful how much you get into this space. But regardless of how much you get into the space, don't get possessed by the spirit of fear where you're underneath them. Like, there is a sense in which we're underneath them and they can be very deceitful and all those sorts of things. But to be human means that you actually, you're the thing they're interested in, but that means you actually have the power, you have the capacity to make choices as to whom you will serve. And the question I find to be really important to come back to what you were, the question you asked, Jacob, like, what can we do specifically? Is like, think about what you serve and actually make a choice of what you're serving, what spirit you want to serve. Because there's a lot of people who just sort of live their lives, you know, based on their own, you know, individual small goals or particular pleasure seeking or whatever. And it's like, well, if you don't have a higher order spirit that you're serving, God, ultimately, I would argue for, if it's anything lower than the absolute highest that you're serving and following after, you're just waiting to be picked up by something. And if you're trying not to serve anything at all but yourself, you're definitely going to be possessed by something. So like the first thing you got to do is actually aim. Like, where you aim is the biggest thing you can do to participate properly. And then I think, yeah, like, Jordan, your armor of God thing is fantastic. Like, pay attention, like, do those sorts of exercises. I love that visualization exercise of putting on the armor of God. But also, when you do that and then really ask the question, what is this armor that I'm putting on, right? If I'm going to use the shield of faith, like, what is faith? And the more, like, take the time to ask that question and never think you've answered it, because the more you learn, and this is true for all the virtues, like, do the practices that cultivate your sensibility of participation with virtues, because the more you do that, the more you actually have that armored capacity. It is going to the gym, right? Meditation, I tell people all the time, right? Like, meditation is going to the gym for your attention. Go to the gym for your attention every day. And get better at noticing, oh, my attention's being grabbed by that thing. Oh, I've been possessed by the spirit of anger over here. Oh, I'm being possessed by the anger or by the spirit of lust over here. And then notice what works as a as a response to that, right? Like, I've been delving deep into the virtue of chastity recently because I'm really interested in having the antidote to the spirit of lust when it grabs me. And it's been profoundly, profoundly life-changing for me, and also just amazing to get to know a virtue that has been basically completely hollowed out and left for dead of chastity. And it does feel like a sort of, you know, girding up with armor to move into a space where where the capacity becomes less, like, it's almost like you need less attention on, hey, what are these exactly and how do I fight them, and just like become integrated as a person, cultivate virtue, cultivate the spiritual practices that have been taught for ages and ages. And what you'll begin to notice is that you can follow that North Star. You can follow God. You can really attempt to move into the likeness of God, and you'll become, you know, a candle set on the hill, and it's not even like you need to do it. It will happen through you.
One question that arose in what you were just sharing when you said, like, nothing can be outside the space of God, raises a really interesting theological question there, because I know for some Christians, and I think in Orthodox Christianity, there is actually the assertion that God, evil actually never touches God or partakes of God and is not of God in some sense. Evil is like apart from God. I don't know what, I can't remember the exact phrasing. Whereas if you look at like Hindu or Vedantic theology, you find that they assert God is all. There's absolutely no boundary whatsoever. And what appears as evil is just as much an emanation of the one light as what appears as good. Whereas Christians are more careful to make distinctions in this respect. They will often distinguish between even like the essence of God and the energies of God, and say that humans will never partake of the essence of God, but we can partake of the uncreated energies of God. Or maybe they say the created energies. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert in Christian theology, but you know, I find that really interesting that Christians do that. And it's just kind of an open question for me, like, how much attention and emphasis and importance should we give to theological nuances like that? I mean, in a sense, you could see it as making a massive difference. Like, are these evil entities, God in disguise, executing God's will just as much as everything else? Or are they free will entities that have somehow become apart from God, and God is not, they're not part of God's plan. They're somehow like anti the divine plan, and they need to be dealt with in order for the divine plan to come to pass, you know? So in that sense, these could be seen as a large theological divergence. So it's an alive question for me currently, is kind of how to rectify those, because for myself, I'm at this point some sort of like integral Christian mystic who's, you know, unexpectedly returned to Christianity and finding a lot of value there, but not willing to reject and disavow all the wisdom that I found elsewhere through a decade plus of very intense seeking and searching for truth in many paths and traditions. So yeah, I don't know if you guys have any thoughts related to that.
I think that's a really, really important question. It's one that I think Ken and I touched on last time we spoke, or one of the last times we spoke, we were touching on this direct theme of the redemptive property of participating in Christ as a kind of sending down of the consciousness into those human experiences of evil, and being like pulling God down into the dark corners and the dark the dark alleys and the dark spots within human experience. And that is no simple task, given the weight of evil that has transpired. So the answer that's coming through in that is almost that it's there's a way in which the Christological component is kind of like a mediator between the two, and it is separate until the process of the unseparating is being done, and that the Christological person is the active enactment of the transformation from that one kind of dimensional reality into the other dimensional reality. But I know that doesn't answer the question of like which one is ultimately true. It's more like, okay, we're kind of there's a possibility of alchemizing and moving in the midst of those. And Ken, I really just wanted to underline and highlight this question of who you serve, or what you serve, what you're in service to, as really being a foundational orientation, and then the basis of attention, which is our most valuable resource. And noticing those attentional leaks. You know, there's a tricky point here, because sometimes I feel like occasionally I have a really, really difficult dream, and the dreams feel like where the spiritual warfare, like I'm being shown things that really, really challenge me, and I just feel shaken up. And sometimes I come out of that and I'm like, all right, I need to get into spiritual warfare mode. I need to go and do some bench press, and I need to like refind my agency, because this thing has kind of blown me over, and I don't feel in my kind of that like agentic sense of being in service to God, that clarity of connection. And yet it's that very space of the gym for me, which is the most difficult. Like you tweeted along a little while back, Ken, like every single space is spiritual. What was it? Like every space is a spiritual.
All of life is a spiritual practice.
All of life is a spiritual practice. When I go to the gym, it's the hardest place to have spiritual thoughts. It's really just a den of lust and performance and ever expanding and cultivating new forms of latex and shapes of clothes. And it feels like like that attentional race is really being waged against me. And it feels like all I can do is kind of just be in it. I can't transcend that. It's a very dense field. So I just wanted to bring that in as an instance of where I'm having some difficulty in this respect. But
I think that's actually, well, I mean, that triggers a bunch of things for me, because that's something I've been really interested in. And because I spend a lot of time at the gym, because that was sort of where the journey started for me, was realizing that like my health needed help. And then that became a cornerstone for me. And then strangely, out of my interactions with other men at the gym has emerged a wisdom group that has been ongoing for 2.5 years now. And in person, we meet every week. And it's been this just beautiful, incredible organic community around wisdom that sprang from the gym. And I totally agree with you, Jacob, like that the gym is so much that space, right? Especially with the hyper superficial pornographic nature of our society. And for me, I love the way you talked about it there, because there is this sense that like, if you're really clear about where you go, where you can go, that will trigger all these sorts of things for you, then for me, at least, it can become sort of an exciting opportunity, because I can actually go into that space knowing that that's going to hit me, knowing that I'm going to be hit by that that the spirit of lust and the spirit of performance and all those things, and just walking into it, you know, do those visualizations, right? Put on the armor before you go there. And then you can go there and be like, hey, this is a disaster. I'm getting rolled today, right? But it doesn't even, you know, it's okay. I'm just going to be with it. And I'm going to notice the patterns. I'm going to notice, just notice until you can get enough space to start to make moves for yourself. But as long as you can go in and come out and go in and come out with that awareness and the noticing, it's like, for me anyway, that's where the space starts to open up. But it's like, there's this thing about, okay, this, let me see if I can tie these two together, because I wanted to talk about, you know, Jordan, your gesture towards theology there. And I'm no official theologian, so I'm just going to claim already, like, nobody has to abide by anything I say. But the way I see it is that it's something like, if the fundamental nature of God is agapic love, then agapic love is this free gift, which has in it the real risk of being abused. And the evil is actually the negative space created by the abuse of the gift. So in that sense, evil is contained within God's nature and God's love, but it's not agentic on the part of God. It's agentic on the part of particulars who have been gifted power from God. But it is absorbed back into God through the person of Jesus Christ. And that somehow, in a way that is profoundly mysterious, it's all actually okay. But I don't, and that's where I think, like, the Christian idea that evil can, like, as soon as you have an idea that there's a place where existence can happen that's fundamentally apart from God, you're not talking about God anymore. Like, you're not talking about the ground of being. You're not talking about, you know, the God beyond God from which existence comes. Because to claim that there's existence, you're already within, right? So I think that way of thinking of it then can sort of provide this space where we actually have the grace to be with ourselves when we notice that we're in the gym and being possessed by these spirits, or at least being buffeted by them and maybe possessed on occasion. We can notice that there is actually a grace that we don't sort of immediately get thrown into hell because of our encounter with these. And that can kind of give us the, is it a faith? Is it a courage? Yeah, it's like a courageous faith to step into the spaces that are part of our life. You know, we all have those spaces that are part of our life to some degree or another where we get buffeted by these forces. And it's like acknowledging my own lack of capacity to hold myself and resting into the truth that I find that I am held beyond myself, regardless of where I go and regardless of the degree to which I have committed sin and been possessed by spirits in the past, then I can start to notice and build anew.
Three things, if I can remember all of them. Number one, like, just wanted to throw out there for anyone for whom this might be valuable. And Jacob, when you were saying, like, you'll wake up from a bad dream and you'll be like, I need to go into spiritual warfare mode to, like, snap out of something. One of my favorite ways to do that personally is to do a, like, baptism with cold water, like, get in the shower and just say, I baptize myself in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and just douse myself with cold water on the head and on the heart space, and just, like, invite Jesus Christ into my body, into my being, and just ask to be cleansed. Sometimes I'll do some breath work and I'll visualize myself breathing in the light of heaven and breathing out whatever's ready to be released, and do breath holds where I'm holding the breath and just charging with the light of heaven and charging up that armor of God with the light of heaven. And so I can just recommend for anyone to play with that practice, because for me, that's very powerful. And for me, for whatever reason, the name Jesus Christ has proven to be, like, the most powerful name to work with in that space of clearing anything from my system. And I don't want to universalize that and say that that definitely means that's true for everyone, or other people might not have other names, but if people resonate with the name of Jesus Christ at all, I can recommend using that in that space. The point number two about going to the gym, it's interesting you guys are saying this, that the gym is like such a superficial place of seductive lust and stuff. I don't really, and now that you say it, I can kind of see that, but I haven't really experienced it that way. So it's just interesting to notice the ambiguity of how we all experience environments differently. For me, I get inspired at the gym, seeing people like working to improve themselves and working to just grow and strengthen themselves and get in better shape and stuff. But actually, the point I wanted to make was around, for me, one of the great equalizers that can connect me to God in any environment is to just, as much as possible, try to completely drop any story I have about the environment and just look instead at the naked fact of being, basically, just the naked fact of being expressed as this particular visual poem right in front of me, which is actually completely unsayable and is just spontaneously shining forth in this moment from the heart of God, as far as I've experienced or can tell. This everything is just an emanation out of the heart of God. And if I can drop all stories about it and just notice, like, this self, spontaneously self-generating, self-gyrating, kind of ever-morphing artistry that we live, then any environment I can, that's for me, one of the best access points to see God in all things and see God's divine artistry, intent, and creativity in all things. That was another point. And then point number three was around, just one more point on the theology piece of like, Vedanta versus Christianity. So I wrote this book called Both Neither Far Beyond Either. And I've been sitting with that in relation to this, like, could it be possible that it's both neither far beyond either? And even though there are these apparent, very like stark differences that lead in different directions, could it be the case that both of these theological systems are true in some sense, and in a sense, neither of them are true, because the truth is always way beyond any system, and that's the far beyond either. So yeah, in that sense, I think it's interesting to consider that, like, I think they can both be true, and I could go into a deeper unpacking of why that could be the case, but I think one way to say it could just be, you know, Christianity focuses more on the distinction of like the levels, like you've got the unadulterated essence of God, and they make that distinct from another level of like somewhat more, you could in a sense call it levels of veiledness, like God's essential nature of agapic love is progressively veiled. And in Hinduism, they focus more on the fact that yes, but all of that is an emanation of that heart of God, and ultimately it is all the heart of God. Whereas in Christianity, they find it important to make greater distinction between these levels of veiledness for the purposes of not misleading people. They find it more dangerous to say, oh yeah, it's all God. Evil is also God. So booyah, let's just celebrate. And it can be useful to integrate both, because in a sense, because you can like see the benefit of the Christian theological understanding and making those distinctions. And then the Hindu side of things can give you more of a sense of like just being astonished that this is literally God right now, and the body of God is all we're ever seeing and experiencing. So anywho, could go more into that, but that was the main point, is that I think it can be both neither far beyond either, and that, yeah, that's cool to consider for me.
That was a really beautiful trio. Thank you, Jordan. I just picture you kind of throwing the basketball into the net. That practice sounds really powerful and useful. And I also, at Kumankaya, found myself playing with this holy water energy. And when I was doing my purge, I was actually like kind of trying to sanctify the water that I had and bless it. And then as I would drink the water, I was kind of imagining like this act of like moving the holy water, moving in and the inside of my body, which is not part of Catholic orthodoxy, but is a really powerful notion. So I definitely encourage people to play with it, and that call to remembering being is a really good place. Remembering the mystery in the midst of the absorption. The last piece I wanted to introduce, and then I'll give closing remark to Ken, is just, you know, there is an ambiguity still around this. There's no ambiguity for me in relation to God, but there is an ambiguity in relation to values and Christianity and what that means for me to live that. And so when I'm in the, it's not necessarily apparent to me that when I'm in deepest connection with God, I'm not going to be like, how does the truth of my lust or my erotic energy like fit into that? And it does seem to me that the value systems that we've been handed down don't address that well. And I am in a process of reimagining how eroticism and Christianity fit together, and that there's ambiguity. And so there's a real necessity for philosophy and for a capacity to kind of have that big G connection. And then with that, like, be trying earnestly to make sense in the ambiguity in between of what that looks like, because it's not necessarily that we have clear cut answers or answers that are fit, and that's just the time we find ourselves in.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, this has been a wonderful discussion. I feel like we could keep going for several more hours. Maybe we can do this again, because this is really wonderful. I'm enjoying this a lot. Find myself somewhat noticing that I'm a little sad that we're coming to the end of our time here. I want to just put a quick plug here. You know, I mentioned the virtue of chastity, and I think that's sort of what you're bringing up here, Jacob, this question of like, how could it be that a tradition that seems to have not valued, especially the erotic, but maybe just sort of like desires in general, has a really difficult time honoring desire? How does that fit? And one of the things, and we can talk about this more, but I think the most, as simply as I could say it, is that what I'm finding in the pursuit of chastity is that it is much more of, it's a deep surprise, because far from being this sort of cutting off of desire and ordering into a very specific box, I think chastity is the virtue by which all desire is honored, cultivated, and brought into its proper expression. And that is actually a deep, deep part of Christianity that's been a real struggle for Christianity, especially over the last, well, I don't know, at least 1,000 years, that's been completely misunderstood. But again, that's a whole other thing. But yeah, I guess overall, I'm just really grateful for both of you guys and the way that we're all sort of, it seems like we have a really interesting dynamism, because we're all seeing it from slightly different angles, but there's a really significant through line that I'm feeling that we all share, and that I'm really, yeah, really grateful.
Yeah, same here. Thank you, guys. Been beautiful.
Absolutely wonderful to bring you both together. And I had to postpone my fast yesterday, so I'm doing my fast today, which is another worthwhile practice in this respect. And yeah, I'm just really feeling the powerful frequency that's coming from this trilogue is really helping me get connected to God. So very grateful for that. And yeah, certainly look forward to joining you both next week and in whatever form we continue this dialogue as well.
Yes. All the best.